This is Nursing Uncensored. Your host, Adrienne Benning, invites you to listen in on real conversations about all things in the nursing world. This podcast is intended for nurses, nursing students, and allied health professionals, but non-medical folk will probably get a kick out of us too. If you like what you hear, subscribe and share. Welcome back, you guys. This is Adrienne, and I'm here today with actually an episode that I recorded, I don't know, maybe back in September. I meant to get it out long before Halloween, so as you listen to this episode, you'll have to endure a few mentions of Halloween. But this whole conversation is basically a continuation of the last episode we put out, so we're going to talk more with Dorothy, the medical examiner investigator, who also used to work as a hospice nurse. So we're going to invite her back and have a conversation about end of life. Lots of things surrounding end of life. So I'll say it again, I've said it before, if you're a little squeamish talking about death, hearing about the processes that our body goes through when we are approaching death, maybe this isn't the best episode for you, or if you're in an area where other people can hear. I don't know if this is like friendly for like just, you know, the general public. We are going to talk about a range of things from like the difference between palliative care and hospice, about our American culture and death and how it's hidden away. We're going to talk about advanced directives and why they're so important and the realities of CPR, as well as a number of other topics surrounding death and dying and our role as nurses. So let's go ahead and jump right into my conversation that went on for hours. So this is another long episode. I apologize, but there just wasn't really anything I wanted to cut out. So here it is in its entirety.
It's absolutely true. Like, I think about it every time I go into work. I was like, oh, what's going to be on the menu for tonight?
Yeah. And you know what? I think that's an important thing to say. So I'll say this on the record. Even though we get frustrated, we get stressed out, we get pissed off, we get annoyed by things, but I still touch every patient like I care about them. And I do, I want them to, you know, even if I just met them, I don't want harm to befall them.
Right.
You know, exactly. If I did, I would get, you know, a job where I have less exposure to bodily fluids. Like, I'm not here because I'm a callous asshole, but you know what? Sometimes I say some things that, you know, might be insensitive. That's why this show is like a safe space so that we all can recognize that we have those moments.
Oh, yeah.
Dude, put down the fucking call button. Like, we have those moments. But yes. We're showing up because we understand that that's what we do. That's what we do.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the same way that moms are like, you know, that I love that that storybook, Go the Fuck to Sleep.
Right.
You know, it doesn't mean that parents don't love their children, but sometimes you're seriously like, go the fuck to sleep. Like, I need you to not be conscious right now before I lose my mind. I don't have kids. I imagine that's what it's like sometimes.
same. It was like,
it's like that with my dog. I'm like, right. I know you think it's time to play fetch in the living room at 3 a.m, but right. The downstairs neighbors probably aren't into it. So we have to be discerning.
I know. It's like, what? Like, I'm bribing my dog, you know, as we speak with a peanut butter bone.
Oh, yeah. So I've discovered that on night shift when I come home and like Doug is at work and I need to sleep and the dog is well rested and ready to go, I'll play with him like intense calorie burning for like 10 minutes. And then I'll give him his antler and he can sit with an antler for 8 hours and he doesn't know that there's another living creature in the room. Like, he loves them so much.
That's a godsend.
It is. And so usually he'll like chew on it for a while and then just like nap with me, cause he's also the laziest animal that was ever born.
that's how Monica is too. We call it like chill or kill. Like, it's like, her kill mode is like, I have to go. And then she'll like just lay down and sleep for 8 hours.
Yeah. And I'm grateful for it because sometimes I need a dog that is just going to be lazy all day. I'm like, I'm so tired. I cannot deal with anything other than what's in this bed. So he gets the antler. He's totally chill. So that's my secret.
Absolutely.
I love it.
So let's get back to kind of what I was talking about earlier before I started this recording. We were kind of talking about our roles in, like, you know, this is a time of year, like I was saying, that we are a little bit more receptive to talk about death than other times of year because, you know, we have Halloween and all the traditions surrounding that. And like also, you know, the earth is kind of going to sleep. So we have the creepies and like, I love Halloween. And so while this is not a Halloween episode, I think that it is, this is my in to talk about death as well, because Americans do not have comfort as a general rule. Like, you know, you've worked hospice before, I work palliative care. And so we've both seen probably a lot of varied ways that people live out the last days of their lives.
And have you found it to be true? A wise old nurse told me once that people seem to die how they live.
Yes. And actually we
talked about this. And that's true. It's a fact.
Yeah. And we talked about this in one of the early episodes that we did, because you talked about how there was an elderly woman that she was falling a lot. You were concerned that she was going to fall, get hurt, even potentially die. But like, she was an independent woman and she was of sound mind.
Right.
She wanted to be at home and she wanted to die at home.
Right.
So what gives anyone else the right to say that she can't die how she, you know, most people want to stay at home. That's a big phenomenon right now, especially as like the baby boomer generation is aging. People want to stay at home. Nobody wants to be institutionalized when they're elderly.
Yeah. Like, yeah, absolutely. I agree 100%. I mean, and also, you know, when I know you wanted to talk about, you know, when people have something happen to them, like they get a cancer diagnosis and they, go through all this treatment, which puts them through, you know, hell. But, you know, and if you know, the cancer is still progressing, let's say, and it's time to have that talk about palliative care or hospice or both, because I mean, they work in hand in hand.
They do. And we'll talk about that. Finish with your line of thought, but then we'll kind of define it a little better for people.
Sure. Well, I mean, I guess you just have to go to people where they are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm sure you absolutely run into this too, where the patient is actually, you know, knows what's going on, and it's important for us to provide education to everybody, but the patient is in one mindset and the family, you know, might be in another mindset because they feel like, oh, this means we're giving up, you know, which is not at all what it means.
So let's talk about two things. I've kind of been jotting things down one at a time. Let's talk about two things. Let's talk about the difference between palliative and hospice, just to give people a basic understanding of what we're talking about. So I, as a palliative care nurse, palliative care is literally symptom management. So we see many people that are, excuse me, I have to burp.
Oh, go for it.
We see, I'm drinking soda with whiskey in it. So
Ooh, I'm drinking beer. So I burp. I'm going to burp too.
But with palliative care, like sometimes we see people that are still receiving curative treatment. Like for example, cancer patients that have like intractable nausea or something that they need a little bit more intensive help managing their symptoms. And then also we see symptom management at end of life, where for whatever reason, like for example, someone comes into the emergency department, they have a head bleed, it is so severe that the family decides that rather than try to prolong this person's suffering, they decide to do comfort care or palliative care, end of life care. So we can work with hospice, which I'll let you explain, or we can function kind of as their hospice almost.
Yeah.
But yeah, so talk a little bit that's kind of how it is in the hospital. Like we manage nausea, pain, you know, vomiting, confusion, agitation. Like we can manage all of these things. Hospice is similar, but go ahead and talk a little bit about what hospice is.
Sure. Yeah, that's it. I mean, it's very similar, except that, I mean, in the hospice that I worked in, We were out in the field. So, I mean, again, you go to where the patient is, whether they live in a long-term care facility, whether they're in the hospital, or if they're in their home. And then we also manage any symptoms that they're having. Some of our patients, let's say, had a lot of pain, especially with bony mets. You know, they offer like palliative chemo. We had patients that did that, but then we would meet them at home after their treatment and manage any symptoms they were having then. Right.
And like palliative chemo is, for example, like we're not giving you chemo necessarily to cure your cancer, but we can help keep the tumor from growing rapidly so that you're more comfortable and you experience less pain or less of whatever symptoms it's causing you. So those are still options, but yeah. And then both also, I'm sure you probably also see people that use like massage therapy, aromatherapy. Like these are all, it's all about making
music,
you not,
right.
Yeah, it's all about making you not feel like shit, basically.
Right. Like anything we can do. Like, so there's like at a home hospice, or if a hospice comes to your home, you know, you have a hospice team. So there's on that team, there's a hospice physician, or we work with your physician, whatever you choose, but we do have a hospice, you know, especially trained hospice and palliative care doctor. We had a couple actually. And then there's a nurse, there's a nursing assistant, there's a music therapist, a social worker, there's a chaplain if that's something that you're interested in. But that's another misconception too, that hospice is somehow religious.
It can be if that's what you're into.
It's whatever you're into. Like we're gonna go to where you are, like, and to where you are, you know, mentally, emotionally, whatever, you know, we can do to help give you comfort.
And this is a big soapbox for me because, you know, a lot of people hear the word hospice and they think you're going to die right now. You're going to die. You're about to be dead. And they can't get past that. And what I want to scream from the mountains is you can get all of these services, pet therapy, fucking have your pain controlled. You can, like there are all these things that we can do. So yeah, if you want to do as much as you can, that's cool. But like, also if you're in a circumstance where, I mean, I can't say what I would do, but I know I would want to not be in pain, to be able to have massage therapy and all of these things that are going to make me feel better. And then in turn, that helps the family that you have as well, because they know that they're doing as much as they can to make your, and it's not just like the last days. Like, okay, so here in Iowa at a particular hospice house that I visited where it was like they did home visits and they also had like a beautiful, beautiful facility with like a limited number of beds, but it was great. It was the kitchen was just, oh my God. That was a place that they said that they can serve people in the community with these needs for up to 6 months, 6 to 8 to, you know, and people come in and out of hospice as they need to. But she said the average length of stay was like 9 days.
Well, and because of the whole thing of not talking about death
and people being scared that means they've given up. You're not
exactly
giving up.
Right. Well,
in fact, you're being more aggressive because we can do more with pain medication and, you know, like.
Right. And chemo is not going to make you sick anymore. You know, like not that all chemo does and not that. And I mean, like we talked about palliative chemo and that's very helpful to some patients, but it's not giving up. And if I would have been a better prepared nurse, I mean, there's tons of peer reviewed articles out there that show that if people are, you know, referred to hospice or palliative care at the, you know, 6 months, you know, instead of 6 days before they die. I mean, you actually have a better quality of life and sometimes a longer, you know, actual, like your quality of life is better. And then, you know, they tend to live longer than they would have if they didn't have.
And, you know, not every circumstance is the same, and I don't want to put any value judgment on the different ways people handle stuff, but like some of the things that I've seen that have been, that have, like, some of the specific families that I remember. So our palliative care rooms are, they don't look as hospital-y as our regular, right. Like there's no, we don't have heart monitors. Like a lot of the medical gases are like hidden behind like nice headboards that like have doors that open and close. You know, the walls are painted lavender and like, you know, there's like dimmable lighting. It's much nicer. We have couches, family can sleep in there. But anyway, I think that people sometimes, like I've seen families that will bring in like an aromatherapy diffuser and yeah. they'll like bring in nice lotion and like give their loved one feet massages and like
or music.
Yeah, like I've seen little old ladies come from the choir from this woman, you know, this patient's church, and they like do a little like musical performance. Like I've seen people do these wonderful things, you know, and I've also seen people that just like can't accept what's happening. And, you know, it, we try as best we can to reach them, to help them have resolution and understand what's happening. And, you know, everybody's well, yeah. different. So, you know,
it's like, you know, going to where they are and it's grief, yeah, right? Like yeah. they're going through all of those grief stages. And I mean, you know, it's, I think just being there and listening and advocating yeah. for them and educating them. Like, hey, like, what are your goals? I'm going to help you try and meet those. And, yeah. you know, I can't promise anything, but I'm going to do my best, you know, to help make you comfortable or whatever your goal is.
Yeah. And, you know, I try to ask patients if they're, you know, if they're able to communicate with me or family members, I say, you know, like what's most important? Like what side do they like to sleep on? What kind of music do they like? You know, did they always have, you know, because we've had some patients that are like younger and the family is like playing heavy metal in the room.
Right.
And it's because that's what that patient like listened to day and night, whether they were asleep, awake, doing homework, whatever. And so you have to meet, like you said, meet them where they are. If that's what they need, if that's what's therapeutic and that's what helps them, you know, have comfort at the end of their lives, that's so important. And, right. You know, like, you know, like we've said, you can also come in and out of hospice. And
oh, so, yeah.
But I've also seen patients that have broken my heart because like they're so firmly rooted in denial. And when someone's in a stage of grieving, you can't force them into another. You have to remember you are a facilitator for them, but you have to be gentle. You cannot force someone to come to a realization that they're not prepared for. And that can be frustrating for us. You know, I had a patient that was, you know, had progressive disease and was suffering and struggling and it was only going to get worse. And she was still a full code.
And all yes.
and all of us were terrified because this person, this patient would not even entertain the idea of palliative care until it got really bad. And that person, I think, got scared and then was like, okay, I'll take palliative care. But it's like, we could have spent all of this time making you feel, because here's the thing with palliative care, you know, even though we are not in the business of hastening death, like yeah. in palliative care, we can give you a little bit more pain medication. We can give you a little bit more Ativan. We can do right. these things to make you comfortable because, you know, the goals are different and it's more important that, you know, we control your symptoms and make you feel comfortable than it is to worry about your long-term kidney function.
Right. Yeah.
Which if you're receiving curative treatment, we don't want to blast your liver by giving you all of this stuff. But, you know, if we know that your prognosis is short, then we can make sure that you don't have a horrible symptom-ridden experience. And I've seen so many people that come into, you know, they're admitted to my unit, they're agitated, they're not really responsive, they're in pain. And then we're able to set up a couple drips, give them a few IV pushes. And we, like I said, we're not doing anything to hasten their death, but then they look comfortable. You know, their face right. relaxes. They're not as thrashy. Families are like, oh my God, thank you so much. You know, she finally looks like she's resting. These people that have been through this traumatic shit. And yeah. so that to me is really rewarding. People are like, how can you work around this? How can you do this? But you do see these circumstances where a person has been given a really bad situation and you're able to make them not hurt. Or not yeah. hurt as much, you know.
Right. Or if they want to hurt, that's, you know, like I mean you can do what you can, but I mean I've had people in hospice, you know, like I don't want pain meds, you know.
Yeah, and that's okay too. I guess that's what I think of most often, you know. Yeah. Because that is the thing that's often most distressing. For some people, they don't have any pain, but the nausea is making them want to lose their mind, you know? Like there are so many other things that are worth that kind of symptom management.
And exactly. So you have to, like, you know, be creative. And what works for one patient is not going to work for the next,
right, you know? Right. And you have to tell families that, and you have to say, like, even though, you know, we all kind of go through the same process when we die, it's, you know, we don't always get the same signs, you know, like, so when I have family members at the bedside that want to know, like, when, and they usually don't say, like, when is this person going to die? Sometimes they do, but they'll usually beat around the bush and be like, well, how long, you know, they kind of like stutter over their words, like, how long? Cause they don't know. Most people, and I didn't before I worked in this industry, most people don't even know what it looks like when you die, what it's like, what your skin, you know, what, how to tell. When it used to be, you know, I think I did some reading, and this is another circumstance where I'm going to be like, well, I read once, but I have no idea where.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, I've been in school for a long time. And so in my readings, I've come across things that said that, like, prior to the Civil War, there wasn't really a funeral industry. And then because they wanted to ship soldiers back home so that their family members could have funerals, they started embalming, and embalmers, you know, turned then into the funeral industry.
Have you read The American Way of Death?
No, but is this kind of something similar that I'm describing here?
That talks exactly. It's a book by Jessica Milford, and it's amazing. And that's exactly what you're talking about, is how we got into the funeral home industry and funerals taken out of the home.
Yeah, because, and also it's interesting because there are some, like, for example, Caitlin Doughty and, like, the members of the Order of the Good Death, they post often about how, like, most people don't even realize that in most states, it is completely legal for you to have a funeral in your home. Or to have a wake or whatever. And in some cultures, that's just what you do.
Right.
And to us, we're like, in my house?
Right.
And it's like, well, yeah, because this is your loved one. Like, and so everybody has a different level of comfort, but because of the way that industry has progressed, it's become less, and now more people die in hospitals than at home. And so that's a greater percentage of people that, you know, they're not being handled by family. They're not being bathed. They're not being, you know, anointed. Right. Whatever it is that people, you know, every culture has its own death ritual. And as Americans, we've become so detached from it.
Well, yeah. And so medicalized too.
Absolutely.
You know, that's, you know, important for, like, symptom management and things. And some people just feel more comfortable. Like, I want to go to the hospital and die. I've had patients, you know, I want to stay home for as long as I can, but when, you know, things start going south, like, I want to go to the hospital, which is absolutely fine. Mm-hmm. And then you have other people that, you know, start out, like, every little thing, they want to run to the hospital, and then they reach a moment where they're like, I don't want to do that anymore. I just want to stay at home. Like, how can I stay at home and die?
And that's what I think is so important, is to recognize if there's this spectrum that people can choose from. And that having a loved one die at home doesn't necessarily have to be the most horrifying thing. Right. And, you know, also hospital care for people at end of life doesn't have to be sterile and medicinal and uncaring. I think it's important to kind of redefine the way we think about these things. But some people, you even say palliative care, and the second you've said it, they're like, nope. And that's you don't even understand really what it is. Let me explain to you.
Exactly.
But some, like, people
You provide them with all of their options, like, mm-hmm. you know, and especially also, I think it's along the same lines, you know, whatever their disease process is, knowing everything you possibly can about it. And certainly you can't predict everything, but like, for instance, you know, a patient with liver disease or, you know, esophageal varices, and like they want to have a home, they want to die at home. You know, it's important to have a conversation about what can happen. Like, mm-hmm.
Does this look like in real life?
Yeah. And so everyone's prepared, and, you know, not that you're necessarily going to have a bleed, but that's a possibility. And if you do, this is, you know, what we need to have with us, you know, and how we'll manage that. And, you know, just not to scare people, but just, hey, I want you to know every possibility, just so then, like, I don't want you to like think about it.
You don't
want
to be caught off guard in right. your home.
Right. And then have someone bleed out and then completely be unexpected.
Right. Exactly. Because not only is that traumatic, but it like, is. That's yeah. an, like, it's easy to have a hospital room cleaned and sanitized. It's much more traumatic and hard to fix when it's in like your bedroom, you know?
Well, yeah. And so like we would do things, I mean, and I have a lot of experience with GI bleeds for some reason. they seem to find me. And, you know, so we recommend like dark sheets, pillowcase, dark towels.
Yeah.
So like if that does start to happen, also, I'm a big advocate of having Versed in the home, like if they want to stay at home, mm-hmm. because if they're having any sort of respiratory distress, that's something you can give them that's fast acting to help take that anxiety away.
Because what a lot of people don't know, Versed is one of those medications that at a particular, it's a benzo. So like it's in the same family as like Ativan.
And Lorazepam. Or yeah, that's
yeah,
Ativan.
Yeah.
Xanax.
and also it's what they use for what people commonly refer to as like twilight sedation, where mm-hmm. like you, like for example, if you're having like major tooth surgery, instead of like intubating you and knocking you out, they might just give you Versed so that you're goofy as fuck and then you don't remember any of it.
Exactly.
And we give those a lot for patients at end of life who are agitated, like, you know, you're uncomfortable. People are like, for all you know, there are some people hallucinate. They think they've got to get up and go to work, you know, sure. even though it's the middle of the night. And so there are lots of reasons that we use. But yes, Versed is one of those that it's great. If somebody's just, if it's unpleasant suffering, like give them that so that they are not also fucking terrified.
Exactly. You know? Exactly.
It's merciful. It is merciful. And yeah. it's okay if people, you know, say like, I don't want certain things done. Like I think we all need to have those conversations before it happens.
Exactly.
Like another soapbox of mine, I have a few of them, is advanced directives. Like mm-hmm. I basically tell people, like, I don't care what your health is. If you're 18 years of age or, you know, of legal consent, you need to have an advanced directive, because at any point, like in this world that we live in, anything could happen to you to render you unable to make your own decisions.
Absolutely.
And so I think that, you know, cause sometimes I'll get an admission and it's like a 20-year-old dude and I'll be like, do you have an advanced directive? And he'll be like, what for? And I'm like, well, cause you have a beating heart and you need to know what you want to have happen to it. If something happened, like you're already in the hospital, like, you know, I mean, I don't say it like that. I'm not a total right. asshole, but yeah, I tell people if you are of legal age, you should have one.
I know. And totally you are absolutely right. And I preach the same. And do you know what? I don't have one.
Girl. Okay. So
I'm a hypocrite.
Each state is different. But in Iowa, you can go to Honoring Your Wishes. You can uh-huh. Google that. And Honoring Your Wishes is an organization that you can basically like have, you can print it out. It's a standard form that says under these circumstances, you know, say like, if I become unable to make my own decisions and blah, 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 you know, there's like four or five choices. One of them is like, at all costs, I want every life-saving option of, you know, all the way down the spectrum to, I want no life-saving intervention. Right. So all of these, you can spell it all out. You can say like, And it gets really specific, like, what about this? And what about this circumstance? And so it takes away some of the struggle that your family has.
Right.
Or if you don't have any family, it makes sure you're not going to suffer through some shit you didn't intend to put yourself exactly. through.
And it is super important. And yeah, like actually honoring your wishes is through the hospice, you know, they partner with the hospice, with Iowa City Hospice, where I used to work.
So what I did for mine is I printed it out. I filled it out. I went to the UPS store with an impartial witness, or the UPS person is the impartial witness because they're, what's the word I'm looking
notarized.
For? Yeah, they're a notary public. And so you can have it done for like $5 and then you can give it to your primary care provider or your hospital or wherever it is you receive care. And then that's legal until you give them a new one that says something different.
Yeah.
And so we
all should have that. And I agree.
And like, for example, the senior center here, they will do, I think, free or discounted notary services or just go through the form with people. So there are resources in the community, but yeah, honoring your wishes is the one in Iowa, but you can look up like advanced directive planning anywhere, and you don't have to involve a lawyer. And I mean, unless you want to, but
right, exactly. It's just, it is so important because, like you said, anything can happen at any time. Like, not to be like, you know, sound the alarms, but it really can. I mean, you see it, I see it. You know, like someone's just going about their day, and they're 21 years old, and then all of a sudden, you know, they get
meningitis in the dorms or shit that you can't even imagine. And I don't think you have to be alarmist, but I think that it's a responsible way to say, like, I'm an adult now. I have the right to make these decisions for myself. Because the other thing is even if you have like you have a parent or a spouse or someone that you know, they know your wishes and they would do as best they could. Also, if something happens to you, they're going to be in a state of shock, grief, like being generally not wanting to think about, okay, what did we talk about that day when we talked about what our wishes were?
Right,
so I think it's important to have these conversations, but this kind of documentation also takes a lot of the bullshit paperwork out of your family's hands.
Oh, absolutely. Because like when someone's in a state of shock, they're not going to be able to remember.
Yeah. And I'm not saying you have to like buy your burial plot when you're 19 years old, or whatever. Like you don't have to pick out an urn, but at least like, you know, tell your family what you want. And it's funny because when I went through this death and dying class that I keep that I keep referring to, they actually had us visit the local funeral home. We saw the embalming room. We saw the crematorium. And some people, it was interesting because there were some people that were like, I could never be cremated. The thought of my body in there burning drives me crazy. I can't. And then other people are like, I can't be buried in a box. Like, it's interesting how people like have these very strong desires and wishes and concepts about what they want and what they don't. But then it's like, well, do you have an advanced directive? Well, no. Well, clearly you have a very strong opinion about this. Like you should put it on paper so that, or if your family can't be reached, you know?
Right. Or your family disagrees. I think we talked about this in my last time I was visiting. It was next of kin, like your legal next of kin. Sometimes that involves, like, let's say you are married but estranged. As long as you're still legally married, that person is your legal next of kin.
Right.
Doesn't matter if you have adult children, you know, like, so if you don't want someone in charge that, you know, is no longer like in your life, like that's important to have these kind of things, kind of documents.
Right. So yeah, I think that these conversations about death are important. And you know, some people are like, well, God, that's so morbid. Well, yeah, maybe, but also it's really practical. You know, it's the thing that unifies us all. Like we are all someday going to meet some end. And I don't think it's necessarily like gloom and doom, but but especially since we live in a time now where like school shootings are common, like I live in a city where a woman was killed at the mall because she didn't accept some guy's advances, which that's a whole other episode. We're going to have to revisit that. Holy shit.
Right. Exactly.
But like, there are these things that, so it's just, I always find it interesting when people are like, oh, I never want that. It's like, well, then communicate that.
Yeah. Make sure that your wishes are known.
Because another thing, you know, I'm getting really gloomy here. CPR and like, depending on the circumstance, like CPR is not like it is in Grey's Anatomy. They don't do chest compressions for 2 minutes and then you sit up and you're, oh God, thank you so much for doing chest compressions. No, like that shit fucks you up. And then the survival rate after CPR like drops every time they have to do compressions on you. So it's
especially in someone that has bone cancer, let's say, like, right. You know,
or other disease processes. Right.
Yeah. Right. It's like, you know, your ribs are going to be broken. So is that something?
And those ribs could puncture your lungs and exactly. Like, it may not work. You may suffer hypoxia. So I'm not saying CPR is amazing. I think everyone should learn CPR. It can save your life. Broken ribs can heal. But also like the rate, I don't know what the statistics are, but they're grim. The statistics of survival after CPR are grim, unless you are fucking healthy and you can withstand that kind of shit. Right. And it started early and you get effective CPR.
Right. Exactly. All of those things like have to fall in line. And I mean, I remember one of my favorite hospice patients, she had COPD, like end stage COPD, and still smoked. And that, you know, that was what she wanted to do. And she didn't smoke when her oxygen was on. So I was very, like, I was like, that's all I ask is that you don't not smoke with your oxygen on, at least when I'm in the house.
But yeah, I recently took care of a patient who had a fire on their face from smoking with oxygen.
I see that. I mean, that's a couple of medical examiner cases were because of that. But we had these talks about CPR because she was still a full code when she got onto hospice. And she's like, well, can I just, we were filling out an iPost. And she's like, well, can I just have a little bit of CPR?
Try it for like a minute?
Yeah. And that's, you know, but I, again, like, I want, you know, my patients to have all of the knowledge. So, you know, I gave her written materials about CPR and the statistics and also told her what the process is like and that she is, you know, these things can happen. So, you know, think about all of these things and then we'll come back and talk about it tomorrow. You know, is that something you want? Like, if your ribs get broken and your lung gets punctured, you may have a chest tube and have to go to the hospital. You know, you said it's important for you to stay at home. So these are, you know, things we need to think about.
And we don't do it because, you know, some people are like, well, you guys just want to talk about the bad stuff. No, I want to protect you from anything that you might not have realized was coming.
Exactly.
Because not all of it is pleasant. And there's so much more that we can do, you know, to make you not have a I am all for people being able to choose what they do with their bodies, both in their lives and in their deaths. And so if your primary concern is that you not be scared or in pain at the end of your life, well, then we need to talk about what that looks like. And not in some people are like, well, that's such more, well, no, let's talk about what you want, not just what you don't want.
Yeah. Because there's going to be a point where you can't tell me. So I need to know.
And you know, like it sounds silly, but in my advanced directive, I've put some, like, there's a space where it's like, is there anything you'd like to add? Blah, 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 blah. And sometimes as nurses, like we can look in the chart and like look at their, you know, iPost, which is basically like, it says, you know, what is it? It's like the Iowa
physicians order.
It basically says like, it's basically your, it's like your code status. It's like you want to be DNR, DNI,
like
both.
What kinds of treatment do you want?
Right. How far do you want us to go? But, you know, oftentimes we can see these things. So, cause they're scanned into the chart and, you know, we have access to this stuff. So sometimes I'll look at them in my own though. I put a little thing because, you know, I work neuro for a long time. I've worked night shift. I've worked with a lot of people that sundown and are confused at night. And I basically put in my advanced directive that like I've been on night shift for like 14 years. Uh-huh. You're not going to get me to sleep at night. I'm a prone sleeper. I cannot sleep on my back. Uh-huh. So if you restrain me and put me on my back at some point and I can't tell you, I am not going to be happy. Like, I'm not going to sleep. I'm probably going to annoy the shit out of you. I'm going to get out of my restraints. Just put me on my side or my belt, you know? So like, this seems really silly, but I put these things because as a nurse, I know what I want to know about patients.
Right.
You know, like, and sometimes
and
sometimes I'll have a patient like that's, you know, can't communicate with me anymore. And I go in to turn them and I turn them, you know, they look okay. Like they look comfortable, but I don't want them to get a bed sore. So I'm going to turn them to lay on the other side for a while, tuck some pillows. And then you turn them to the other side. And all of a sudden you see them curl up in a way that you go, oh, that's how you sleep.
Right.
Because I feel like, you know, people have these little idiosyncrasies about them. And as a nurse that does end of life care, when patients don't know they're being observed, they don't really necessarily know what's going on around them. They can't really do things for themselves. But then you see like these details about them.
Right.
You can tell, and then the family will come in and be like, oh yeah, he's been a side sleeper his whole life. And you're like, oh, that's why he's finally comfortable. Cause I put him really far on his, you know, and it's interesting the things that are important and why it's important for family to be around, you know?
Well, yeah. While you were talking about that, I was thinking when I do my advanced directives tomorrow that I cannot stand the feeling of like sheets against my skin, mm-hmm. or especially my feet. So like
Just going to say that some people are like, oh no, dad always had his feet uncovered. And it's like, hey, I'm going to do that then because that's exactly right.
Like those little booties, put those on my feet because I don't want my feet.
You don't want to feel it. Yeah. You know what? That's totally legit. And anytime people say those things to me, I either write it on the whiteboard or I pass it on to the nurse because not only is it important for the comfort of the patient, but that's important for the family. Like this is how they know this person. This is how they like, you know. I don't know. Like we had one fella that I took care of that was confused as hell. Like he didn't know what the hell was going on. We found, excuse me, I'm so burpy. I need to not drink carbonated beverages when we record. But this one guy, he was so agitated. He wasn't sleeping at night. And then somebody found a Johnny Cash DVD. It was like a compilation of live Johnny Cash performances, all these different country music performers from across the decades. It tapped into a part of this man's brain that made him chill, but he couldn't remember that he had just, you know, he had very short-term memory, poor short-term memory. And so like then the DVD would end and we'd start it over again and he'd be like, oh, Johnny Cash, this is a great one. And I'd be like, let's watch it.
Right.
So, you know, to him, he's experiencing it new each time. But if I hadn't known that about him, he probably would have had like another agitated, uncomfortable night that made the nursing staff crazy.
Well, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just the little things like, those kind of details are very important.
And those things are ingrained in us, even when we're not in our right minds or we're not able to communicate, you know, like, you know, some people, even though they're not really responsive, this is something else I want to talk about. Interesting phenomena around people who pass away, because I've seen a lot of patients who, for whatever reason, they're not comfortable or they're in pain or something's wrong. And then as soon as we get that pain under control, even though, okay, and I want to be very careful about saying this. Again, we do not hasten death. We do not overdose people.
No.
We still are very careful about watching respiratory depression and these sorts of things. So this is something that we're always very conscious of. However, if somebody's in a tremendous amount of pain for something that maybe wasn't treated at all, let's say it that way. So they were receiving no treatment. We get their pain under control with a reasonable amount of medication. And then that person, once they're able to relax, they seem to pass, not because And this is hard to explain, but because they've been suffering for a long time, you know, and some people I feel like they can't die until they're kind of at rest, you know, or at peace.
Right. Or, I mean, the most common thing I've seen in hospice is waiting for a certain person.
It
doesn't always happen, but it is fairly frequently I've had where you know, I've had patients that have not had fluids or food in like 11 days.
Yeah.
And you know,
and they're still hanging on. They keep asking for that grandson or that daughter.
Well, even if they're like unresponsive and it's like, but they're just not, you know, they won't let go. And so like one of the biggest questions I would always ask in that situation is like, well, is there anyone else that would like to see them that they would like to see before, you know, they die? And yeah, I mean, it's strange. I can't explain it scientifically, but I've seen it. It happens.
And there's a family that I remember very specifically. So I'm going to be very careful. This was years ago that I took care of them. So I'm going to be very, very specific. There's not really any details to breach. It was a large family. Their mother was at the end of life. And I mean, they had been there for like days and days and days. I don't remember what her diagnosis was, but she wasn't responsive, but she was, you know, she had been there a long time. They were all kind of keeping vigil. There was always somebody at the bedside. And this was one of those families that like, it smelled good in the room and they like massaged her feet and, you know, they like sang songs. It was very sweet. It was great to see that stuff like that exists because the family kind of rallied around her, treated her like a queen. But then after like several days, and this was a huge compliment to me. And the reason I know all of this is because they actually wrote a letter to my boss about this like a year later. And I was also kind of like, wow, they remembered it a year. Anyway, she had been hanging on for days and they came out, all this big group of adult children came out and they said, you know, we feel really comfortable with her under your care. We said a prayer with her and we told her that that we were all going to leave and that if she wanted to go, that would be okay. And we're going to go to dinner and you can totally call us at dinner and we're not going to be upset if you call in the middle of dinner. Just, you know, if anything happens, this is our cell phone number. We'll be back in like an hour, hour and a half. And I shit you not, like a half hour after they left, she died.
Oh yeah. Like some people just want to die alone.
Yeah. And, yeah.
And you have to tell families it's okay to leave.
Yeah. And they have to understand that sometimes that's what people want.
Right.
So all these different things, waiting for someone that they wanted to see, and then that person shows up and then, you know, sometime later they pass more comfortably, whatever it is, like people talking about like, I need my shoes. I need my shoes. Like all of a sudden, like they've been peaceful for days and now all of a sudden they can't shut up about their shoes.
Right.
Because whatever their experience is, they're like preparing for, and there are whole books written about this.
Right.
I wish I could remember the name of the book that I read in school, but it was a whole book that was from nurses, doctors, nursing assistants that had compiled stories about their experiences about stuff like this, where people, there's like categories that are really common. Travel, suitcases, shoes, that sort of thing. Or people that, you know, are like fixated on a person that they haven't seen for years. Like they start talking about their mom, even though their mom's been dead for 45 years. Like these are, you know, they start to see things or they start, you know, there's all these different things that people experience and express before they die. Some people rally. Like some people, you've seen that before, where like someone who hasn't moved independently in days suddenly is like talking, wants to eat dinner, you know, has like a great day with the family. And then the next day they decline and they die.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that I'm sure you guys all talk about too, is it's like, what did these end stages look like? Like what are possibilities? And that I've seen the rally quite a bit too. And then, and then they die.
And those rallies are always usually marked by family being like, I couldn't believe it. She opened her eyes and she knew what was going on. And she yelled at me for not wearing a coat. And like, you know, and then she ate 4 pounds of mashed potatoes and then fell back to sleep. You know, it's like people, I mean, I joke about it, but also sometimes it's really sudden and everybody's like, okay. All right. Yeah, cool. Yeah. And then, sometimes the nurses are like, you know, here, this might've been the last, you know, final big, you know, crescendo with the family. And so, you know, sometimes I'll even say to family, like, you know, this is great. I'm glad you guys have had this time together. Like, you know, I'm just going to keep an eye on her, make sure that everything's okay. And, you know, some, you know, I don't say like, well, she's probably going to die now. Like I have to be sensitive. You have to be sensitive, but you also have to be honest.
Well, so, you do. Cause I mean, death is certain. Like,
yeah.
Like well, who said that? Like Ben Franklin, like taxes and death.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Those are the certainties in life.
Yes.
But, you know, some other things that people, especially other nurses, like new nurses that have like either come in with me to help do care on an end of life patient, or like they've asked me for help with something and they are like, oh, I like how you worded that. And right. So I've learned a lot of things from other nurses that I'm like, oh, you explain that in a really nice way, or like that was direct without being aggressive.
Right.
So, exactly. You know, I say to people like, you know, some families are like, well, what's going to happen now? And it's like, well, you know, every person's death is a little bit different. And also I'm one of those people, there's like this age old argument of like, do we say the word death? Do we say pass away? Like what language do we use? And I do think that everything we do is case by case, even though we have a set of standards. But I believe that as long as there's not some horrible trauma that's occurring, you know, that you say that you do, you don't have to be like, well, she's dead. You can say like, well, you know, as people approach death, these are the symptoms that I'm looking for. So I can't promise that I can predict.
Right.
But I can notice when like her breathing has changed, the temperature and color of her skin. I can tell, you know, when she starts, you know, we start to hear sounds like this, or we see things like this. Right. So I'm not going to say like, well, this happens, then this. And I also, people are sometimes also like at night, they're like, can you wake me up? And I'm like, well, I don't always get warning. But if something changes, I'll wake you up and let you know, right. But so, and people usually understand that, but people don't, you know, they don't understand the symptoms, you know, like one of the things that I think has been talked a lot about very indelicately among non-medical folk is, you know, the term, the death rattle. Mm-hmm. Which really what that is that's, and I explain this to people as well. It's like, well, this is more distressing to us because what you're hearing is they're not, you know, they're not able to clear their throat or mm-hmm. swallow. And so all of the, like the kind of saliva and secretions are all just kind of pooling at the back of the throat. And it sounds like this wet kind of rattly, and we can do some things to make it less, but we can't entirely, you know, take it away.
Right.
But some medication helps, and, you know, we can try to position this person in such a way that, but, you know, people are really distressed by it.
Oh, yeah.
And, absolutely. You know, for a lot of people, they're like, I've never heard of that before. Or some people will say, is that the death rattle?
Right.
And, you know, I say, well, you know, that's what some people say, but like really what it is this, you know, and we, you know, this is how we talk about, you know, so there can be delicate ways to talk about very direct things, you know?
Right. I mean, so it's strange, but like, as far, I mean, like I say dead or dying or death, mm-hmm. it maybe like in my current job now, it's just important because it's unexpected, not unlike in hospice and palliative. Right. I mean, sometimes it's still unexpected, right? But we're anticipating that death is going to occur at some point. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just kind of, I always use like dying, death, or dead.
Right. Because in your circumstances, the family or loved ones that you're talking to,
right.
This person may have been completely healthy 8 hours ago, you know?
Right. Well, even now. In hospice too, because it's like, I mean, yeah, you, it's all about phrasing, but
yeah.
Just that, I mean, I'm, you know, it is something that like, that's going to be the end game here. You know, I know that probably sounds really insensitive, but sometimes people just have a hard time, like they don't want to accept it, and that's okay. That's part of grieving.
And you can't, and like we said earlier, you can't force them into a different
place. Exactly.
In their head.
Exactly. They have to get there on their own. So, I mean, it's not something that you even have to bring up initially, but if they're like in the dying phase, the actively dying phase, yeah, it's very interesting the things that you can see.
Yeah. And so, you know, people, you know, become less arousable, their breathing changes, they have periods of apnea. So like, we are used to seeing all of this.
Right.
But like, we don't get those warning signs when it's something that maybe happened in their home or was a result of like carbon right. monoxide poisoning or something that just completely unexpected and out of the blue. And I think, you know, it is important that we use language that is not confusing.
Right.
Some people think it's kind of harsh, you know,
right.
but also I think it can be misleading. Like if you say, I'm sorry, they're gone. Well, mm-hmm. where did they go? What do you mean?
Right.
And then you don't want to have to explain to them then, well, actually, I mean, they're dead. You know, like I think that there are ways that we can be direct and still be kind.
And be sensitive. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's, well, that's why you're my nursing soulmate, because that's exactly the point I was trying to get at. But I'm like, maybe I drank too much beer.
Well, and you know, there was a patient that I took care of recently, and their family member who had just arrived had no idea. And this person was very actively dying. Like uh-huh. they were having long bouts of apnea. They had kind of that secretion gurgle, which was difficult to control and for sure. a number of reasons. But anyway, she, you know, arrived kind of late in the evening and like was kind of surprised, like just heard that the patient was, you know, was there. And so she was kind of like very caught off guard. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sure. I said, and I can't remember what we were talking about, but I remember I said to her, like, I don't say this to be cruel, but I say this to be clear. Because this patient was like, God, I'm trying to remember what the context was, because otherwise this isn't a good, I'm not making a good point. But basically the point that I had made was like, I need to communicate this to you because I don't really have a lot of time to dance around words.
Right.
And she was very appreciative. She was like, okay, all right. I just, you know, thank you for telling me that. But I wasn't insensitive about it, but I was like, you
right.
know, I need you to know. Oh, I remember what it was. It was someone who had fallen and had a brain bleed.
Sure.
And so this was a young person. Well, young to be falling and dying of brain bleed. So this sure. person was maybe in their 20s or 30s and had taken a fall, and the bleed was severe enough that it was like inoperable. And so the family had chosen to extubate, like take out the breathing tube and move into comfort care. But then the dad of this patient was convinced that they had made a mistake and they gave up too quick, and like, they wanted to make sure that we knew that there was nothing. And so this mom was more receptive to like me talking about like, well, these are the symptoms I'm looking for. And the dad wasn't there. And she was like, well, I want to know so I can tell him that we didn't give up too soon. And so this, you know, this woman had no pupillary reflexes whatsoever, no response to light. And that's what I did. I said, I don't do this to be cruel, but I do this to be clear so that you know that what we're seeing. And she looked and she said, oh yeah, there's no response. Her eyes aren't moving. Mm-hmm. And I said, that's one of the ways, one of the many ways that we know that there was no fixing this. And in that instance, if you said that to somebody else, you might be like, oh my God, that's really kind of not cool. They were conflicted that she was still in there. They were conflicted that they that they gave up too quick. Mm-hmm. And so in that instance, I felt, and she was grateful. And she was like, thank you for explaining that to me. And she did, I think, talk to her husband about it, because I had this person like a few nights in a row. But that was one of those circumstances where I was like, I am not doing you any favors by using unclear terms. Like you need reassurance that we are sure, you know, that mm-hmm. we're not just giving up. So that's kind of an extreme circumstance, but I've had these interactions with patients where they're like, don't lie to me. Like, please just tell me what I need to know, because they need to be at rest with their decision. You know?
Well, yeah. I mean, I found the same, where people just, they want you to be direct with them. And, you know, instead of like, one of my favorite, and this is probably going to sound bad too, but, you know, when you have patients and they're on palliative care or hospice and you can't say the word to them, have you had that? I'm sure.
Yeah. I actually have also taken care of patients who like are imminently about to like come to the end of their life and they refuse to acknowledge it. Kind of like that patient I was talking about earlier, like was a full code. And like, it's hard because they're like, you go in there and you even say like, we should talk about like not even that they're not receptive. They don't even want to hear it. Like,
right.
And your heart is breaking for them because you're like, God save me from having to crush your chest later, knowing that it's going to do no good.
Right. I know.
When instead I could be giving you aromatherapy and putting you on pillows and giving you pain medicine, which is what ended up happening with this particular patient. But some people, they do meet an unsettled end because they couldn't get to that place where they could hear it, you know?
Right.
And I can't judge that because I want everyone to meet the end of their life with peace and comfort. Of course, that's what I want. Like, I don't wish suffering upon anyone, even the people that have done me wrong. I don't even wish it on them.
That's
how much I love people. But the point is that like we also, I feel that one of the reasons that I wanted to talk about this on the show is that not just nurses educating patients that are facing death or families that are facing death, but as a culture, we need to understand this better so that we're not fucking terrified by it.
Well, like we talked about, not every death is the same. There is a process. And yeah, like let's talk about that more with people. And I mean, but you have to also be willing to learn about it too, or wanting to know. But like, hey, like, you know, when someone reaches this stage, like they're not going to eat as much anymore. And they, you know, a lot of focus for patients and families that haven't been through the process before, it's like, oh, well, if they don't have water, you know, they're going to die.
And let's talk about that for a minute, because we as a culture very much equate food with comfort, hence the phrase comfort food. Exactly. And actually, I have a future episode planned where I want to delve into this a little bit more. But one of the things that really trips people up, especially female caretakers, so wives, moms, sisters, or, you know, female partners, whatever that caretaker role happens to be, it's usually women, and I'm making a sweeping generality, it's usually women that are like wanting to feed that person, even though it's going to make them feel sick. They're not digesting it. They're not burning calories. They don't want it. But that family member equates that with comfort, that feeling of being full and happy and satiated. But at the end of life, like, it's true. If you haven't been out of bed in 3 months, you're not burning off that 4-cup serving of mashed potatoes that your mom tried to give you, like, or your wife or whoever.
And everything is just slowing down.
And people, you know, become less interested in food and less interested in drink. They become, you know, less aware or less participatory in what's going on around them, even though they may still be able to hear and like enjoy the voices of people around them. They can still perceive that. So, you know, I also remind people, like, continue to talk to them, sing to them, tell them about your day. Try not to argue. Try not to talk about, you know, like if I hear family that's, you know, I say, hey, like they can probably understand everything you're saying. So fighting over the jewels is probably not a good idea right now.
Right. Oh my goodness. Yes.
And some people do that.
They do.
We've had people like fist fight over patients' beds, their deathbeds.
Well, and that's another thing that's an important point. Death can bring out the worst in people.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah. For lots of different reasons. Some people, money. Some people, because that person that's dying was the peacekeeper, was the head of the family. Or, you know, because suddenly people that haven't been in a room together in decades because they had a falling out are now brought together because they want to see this person. Like, there's so many reasons that non-functional families. And I love to have family present. I want family present as much as possible because then usually people are more relaxed and we know the nuances of like how to keep them comfortable and happy or whatever.
But well, exactly.
But sometimes that family relationship is not good and you're like, oh my God, if you would just stop talking to them, maybe they go, Mom, are you sleeping? Are you tired? Are you in pain? What about this? What about this? Right. What about? And you're like, good God, nobody could sleep. If you were doing that in my ear, I would punch you in the lip. Like,
right. And they probably would too, but they can't right now.
But they can't. So I have to be their advocate. And
you do.
Shut up.
Well, yeah. I mean,
and it's hard to do.
Palliative and hospice nurses, I mean, we are major peacekeepers. And just being able to, I mean, all nursing, but I mean, yeah, like you find yourself in, yeah, these crazy family dynamics at end of life. And then, you know, especially if they haven't experienced death before, or even if they have, you know, it's a loved one, it's different.
And some people don't know what's okay. Like they're worried about being judged. Like,
right.
For example, I've had like partners whose, you know, their partner has died, whether that's their husband, their wife, girlfriend, boyfriend, whatever. And they're like, well, after they've died, they're like, well, can I lay in bed with them for a little bit? Absolutely. Of course. Absolutely. Of course. But some people ask that, like, they're like whispering like a dirty word to me. It's like, absolutely. That is okay.
You take as much time as you need because now, I mean, you know, you can take all the time that you need.
Yeah. And, you know, our hospital is lucky enough that we have a policy that, I mean, we're not going to be like, we'll keep the body up here for 13 hours while so-and-so drives in from Kentucky. We're not going to do that. But like, if somebody's like, okay, my family member's 45 minutes away, that's fine. Tell them not to be unsafe getting here. Just, well, you know.
You'll accommodate. Like,
and then I also have to tell people, like, I also have made it part of my routine that I say, if you want to leave, that's okay too. Because some people have been there for days. They haven't showered. They haven't eaten. They haven't rested. And so some people are like, is it okay if we just go? And it's like, yes, yes.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All the rest is on me. And I, you know, so people need to understand that there's no right or wrong response, but that, you know, if they need something, there are limits to what we can accommodate. But like we've had people of particular faiths that they want their bed to be facing a certain way when they die. So like some people want their bed facing towards Mecca, or some people want there to be certain people, like some people don't want males. If it's a female patient, they don't want females in the, you know, or they want same gender staff. Mm-hmm. Or like, you know, I've seen some folks that they say that they need, I can't remember what culture. Anyway, we've seen lots of interesting different things that are new to me as a white person in the Midwest United States, where like one person was like, the window needs to be open so that their soul can leave. And so we're on the seventh floor. We were like, okay, well, we gotta, you know, what can we do to accommodate this without like making a huge like fall risk of somebody tumbling out a seventh floor window? But like we try to accommodate those things because we recognize that there's not just one right way to meet the end of your life.
Right.
And if we are people that are blessed enough to get to make some of these choices, then, you know, we need to try to accommodate them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Some people want, like I said, you know, I have that one patient that their family was playing heavy metal and it wasn't loud. Like you could just hear it in the room, but,
all right. You know. I'm going to have Fugazi playing when I die. I mean, they should be able to have whatever, you know, within reason that you can do, you know, to help them along, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And make them comfortable.
Absolutely. So I think that, you know, a lot of people don't know this stuff. Even a lot of nurses are nervous about it because maybe they work in an area where they don't see a lot of death, you know, like for example, someone who's on a med surge unit and maybe there's a code once in a while, but it's not like there have been times, like as a nursing assistant on my unit, we were the ones responsible for you know, once the person is kind of like cleaned up in the body bag, ready to go down to the decedent care center, AKA the morgue, mm-hmm. it's our nursing assistants that usually go down with security, so that the nurse can remain on the on the floor for the patients that are still alive and needing.
Right.
It doesn't take a licensed staff person off the floor. So as a nursing assistant, my record, I think I probably went down to the DCC like 4 or 5 times in one shift because we had patients that all kind of died in the same time span. And so, also, you know, we need to, you know, we communicate to people like you can leave, you can stay. Some people want to know like what we're doing. Some people want to stay right up until that moment. And then it's kind of like you said, I have to prepare them. I have to say, well, okay, these are the things that we do. Like for another thing is, for example, if it's someone who wanted to be an organ donor, then the iBank usually screens them to see if they're candidates to donate like corneas or lenses or what, you know, there's a variety of things people can donate. And so they'll call us. And so one of the things we'll do to kind of quote unquote prepare the body is after the person has died, we'll put, you know, a nice amount of saline, like eye drops in their eyes to keep the eyes moist. And then we take an ice pack. We, you know, place the ice pack over their face and then we just raise the head of bed or the cart just a little bit so that there's not a lot of like edema and swelling or whatever.
Like blood doesn't pool. And
exactly. Exactly. Pool. And, you know, we routinely do things like this. So like if, you know, the family is present, I say, well, I'm going to put an ice pack over her eyes, you know, before we put a sheet, you know, and I had a patient a few weeks ago that I was like, when I tell people the steps, I always kind of pause in between each one because I had a patient that right before I was about to say, and then I put her in a body bag. She was like, okay, I think that's all I want to know. And I said, Okay, that's fine. And I said, just know that everything I do with the same care as I would if she were alive and able to talk to me, you know? I might not say it like that, but I say like, I treat them like they are one
with
of
respect
or So, but everybody kind of has a different level.
Threshold.
Like some people are like, I want to help you put her on the cart or him on the cart that goes down, you know, like, and so I try to accommodate whatever that person needs for their level of healing, because it's not about me. It's about me facilitating an experience for them. So I try to be respectful, but also, you know, again, you have to warn them. You have to say like, well, you know, you might see this or you might hear this or whatever. So, I think that those are important moments for people to have. And I've even been part of those moments with people that I have loved that have died, like either being able to see them after they passed away or being able to help with their final cares, as well as for my dog that I lost years ago. He was having grand mal seizures and my vet came to the house and we euthanized him in my home. And she was like, you know, her son, you know, the vet's son was there to help as well. And she was like, he was a huge dog. He was like over 100 pounds. And she was like, we can take him out of here. And I was like, no, I want to help carry him out. So we made a little stretcher out of a sheet. That was what I needed. I couldn't watch somebody else carry him out of my house. And so even though, you know, that's my experience with my dog, you know, I think
that's a family member.
That's a family member. And also I think people are more humane with dogs. Like, we'll euthanize a dog that has metastasized bone pain.
Right.
But if it's someone, a human being who wants it, we're like, that's unethical. Well, whatever your feelings about that, even though I'm using my funny voice and being kind of like a little snot about it, we think about, well, oh, my dog is a good dog. She doesn't deserve to suffer. Yet we'll let people deal with like horrible, debilitating illness for years. That's a whole other.
Well, yeah, no, I totally agree. I mean, I'm all for euthanasia.
There are places that are doing it successfully without the exploitation of the people utilizing the service.
Exactly. And I mean, like Oregon and Washington have physician assisted, like death.
It's kind of an old documentary now, but the documentary How to Die in Oregon.
Here, I love that one.
Yeah, that one was on, I'm going to real quick.
It was on Netflix. I don't think it is anymore.
I don't know if it is, but that one is a really, really good one. It was one of the first ones. Actually, it was the second one that I saw. The first one that I saw was called The Suicide Tourist, and it was about a man who had ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, basically, like, you lose your ability to move your body until you can't breathe anymore. It's horrible. It's one of the worst things I think I've ever come across in medicine. But this man wanted to, you know, have the option of death with dignity, controlling the timing and place of his death, but it wasn't legal anywhere in the United States at the time. And so he had to go to, like, Norway or some shit, where they have a different culture and relationship with death, and this Death with Dignity Act, as it's been called. But yeah, How to Die in Oregon. One of the things I remember the woman saying in this documentary, she said, you know, she was able to get a prescription for a medication that if she were to drink would cause her to have basically like fall asleep, have respiratory failure and die. And she had some advanced form. I can't remember if she had cancer or she had something that, she could no longer treat. And she said something like, once I had the medication and I knew I had the choice, I could forget about it.
Exactly.
I could just live my life and be with my family because I don't have to worry about what horrible shit is about to befall me. You know?
Exactly. Yeah. That I recommend that one all the time. And when I taught nursing students, that was the first documentary I recommended they watch. Like after our first day, I'm like, go home if you have time. I know you don't because you're a nursing student, but
put this in your post-graduation reading list. I also think that people who see things like that also need to see Frontline has done a number of documentaries. One in particular that is not specifically related to euthanasia or hospice, but it's one. Oh, let's see if I can find it.
I was looking for that too because it's like 20 minutes long, but it's fantastic.
There's also one that they did. It's called Facing Death.
Yeah,
and it's a Frontline. It's like a PBS. It's available online. You can find clips or the whole thing. But basically, it's about really how people are dying in hospitals, like what kind of stuff they're being put through, experiencing, what it really looks like to die in a hospital. And so more people die in hospitals than ever before in our country's history. That kind of detachment from, you know, death and dying. We intubate and drain everything, basically. And I think that it's important to watch those documentaries as well, because even though people are like, well, that's morbid, I don't want to think about it, but it's like, if you're in a car accident, where do you think you're going to go? If you're at a concert and somebody decides to open fire, which I hate that we live in a place that happens, but that happens so much, you've got to think about that. You know, like, so I think that, you know, and some people that, you know, just have come out of nursing school, this is also a shock for them. So providers, families, patients, they don't know necessarily what all of this means. So that's where the nursing role of educator comes into play, because you need to say like, hey, I know you don't want to talk about this. Nobody does, but your choice.
Unless you're people like us. I mean, some people do.
Well, and some people do, but they don't think it's okay to, so they stifle your questions.
Well, we are telling you right here and now that it's okay to talk about. And
absolutely. And it's one of those things that sometimes people are like, can I ask? It's like, yeah, you can ask me some questions. But they're afraid to ask, or they don't know how to word it, or they're afraid they're being insensitive, kind of like you and I have even been careful to talk about it, because it can be a traumatic, sad thing, but it can also be a really beautiful thing. People think that we're intervening too far, but it's like me putting an IV in your arm is intervening with your body's natural processes. You know, like getting blood or having surgery, like these are all intervening with quote unquote natural processes, but some natural processes are very destructive also. And so I think that by talking about what happens when we die and, you know, kind of being a little bit, giving people a space, even if people aren't going to like listen to this episode and then be like, oh, I can talk about this with anybody all the time over lunch. But, you know, if it can inspire someone to either like have that conversation. Like, I didn't have that conversation with my mom until like the day after my dad died. Mm-hmm. And then we were like, well, now's as good a time as any. And it was difficult, but like, you know, those conversations need to be had. And we had that conversation in a time of trauma. So it was healing right. for us, but it might not always be that way for other people.
Well, right. Right. I mean, you know, like in my situation, you know, I have two half sisters with my dad who died. They're my sisters, but with my mom, I'm the only child. So, you know, I've had talks with her about that because she's, you know, like in her mid-60s, which is young, but you know, it's
my mom too. Yeah.
And it's like, well, mom, you know, I know she's completely independent right now, but you know, if things happen, like what are your wishes? Like, what would you like to happen? Like, let's say something happened and you couldn't make decisions. Like, you know, I'm her legal next of kin and also, you know, in her advanced directive, but you know, it's like, we had to talk about those things. Like, I want to know what your wishes are, even though you might not want to talk about them, you know, at this very moment, but start thinking about what you would like. So I know, so I make the right choice for you and yeah. respect your wishes.
And you know, this is the perfect time of year to use Halloween as your cover story,
right?
to talk about the veil between the living and the dead. And hey, mom, do you want to be cremated or what?
Right, right. Do you want a Viking funeral? Because I do.
Yeah. yeah, and I think that these are great things to talk about, and I don't think they need to be, because here's the thing, once you talk about it, granted, you might want to talk about it, like, as your life changes, like, oh, now I'm married, now I have kids, now I have to think about who my priorities are, and who the people that I want to speak for me are, yeah. so, like, you have to change with those life milestones, but also, it's like, once you have that conversation, unless something changes, that talk is in half. You know, like my mom and my partner, they both know that I want my ashes scattered to the wind in some place they deem beautiful. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they also know that I don't want to spend weeks and months on a ventilator.
Right.
So these things, we've had these talks and now the talks are had. And now we right. can get back to like enjoying our day to day. So
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, you can check that off the list, you know, so everyone knows what you want, what your wishes are, and then, you know, move on to other things. But the stigma, like, you know, what we were talking about, I just want to get rid of that stigma. And I mean, besides educating, you know, I constantly am trying to think of different ways, like, to communicate that to people, that it's okay.
Yeah, and it's okay to be scared to talk about it.
Oh, yeah, and it's okay to be, I mean, you know, it's, if you're scared of death, okay, let's talk about it. Like, let's talk about why, like, you know, and maybe I can help, you know, set your mind at ease about some things that I've experienced helping other people die.
Especially knowing that people do have choices, you know, and as you know, we move forward, I hope our culture, especially since we have the baby boom generation, while a lot of young baby boomers are still very young, vital, very, like, very much, I mean, what, like, 60 is the new 40. I feel right. like I know more people that are, like, in that age range that are, like, doing bike competitions. And like, so I was actually, also kind of funny, I was talking with Doug just the other day about how old people look different from our generation. Like, what are old people going to look like in 20 years? Like, I know people at the senior center are going in wearing, like, Chuck Taylors and, like, rock band t-shirts.
Right.
So it's not, you know, demographics are changing, but it also means that, you know, we're going to have a lot more people that are needing end of life care, you know, facing mortality as well as vitality. I think those things have to go hand in hand. Uh-huh. But I think that these conversations really need to be important because we all know a baby boomer and we all know people that, you know, are going to someday, whether that's soon or not, are someday going to die. And so that.
Well, yes. Yep. It's going to happen.
Okay. So I want to end this on a funny note. Yeah. I can't put it in the episode because I'll have to pay him like a shit ton of money. Uh-huh. But William Shatner has a song that it's kind of a spoken word, but he's like, live life like you're gonna die, because you're gonna. It's like, so for everybody, go out there, find the William Shatner song. And then he goes on to say things like, and they're probably gonna die too. And it's humorous, but also he's basically like, yep, live life like you're gonna die.
Exactly. Well, and also do you watch Black Mirror at all?
I haven't. It's on my to-do list. Everybody's been telling me about it.
A lot of it's disturbing, but I highly recommend the episode San Junipero, and it's amazing. And it also has a lot to do with what we're talking about on this podcast about, you know, death and dying. And it's excellent, that episode.
All these resources for people to go check out. And yeah. I've also mentioned it before. I kind of want to sneak this in as we like start to wrap up this episode, is that there is online, there's the Order of the Good Death. And we've mentioned this before. And this is just the group that I kind of follow and I love. So Google them. I actually think their web address is, it's like the Order of the Good Death.com.
Yeah, they have a YouTube thing.
They do. And so Caitlin Dowdy is probably like the most well-recognized member of the Order of the Good Death. Mm-hmm. But also in this group, there are also other like writers, people in the funeral industry, other academics, artists. So like there's a number of people involved in this. She is the one who has become kind of like internet YouTube famous for, and I love her. I've been watching her videos forever. Yeah. But she is the Ask a Mortician video series.
That is excellent.
She also like is owner of a funeral home in LA. And anyway, the Order of the Good Death website, there's like a lot of essays, videos, there's like a blog, there's all this information. And it's, some of it is so beautiful. Like the ways, you know, she's written books about death cultures around the world, you know, death traditions around the world. There's so much great information and beautiful stuff. Like it's not all like scary, creepy, morbid shit. Like it's actually, I think everybody should like check out the videos, you know, check out the website. I think it's a great resource. I'm just scrolling right now. I'm a little distracted because I'm like, oh, I haven't read that article this browser window.
I know.
Like, oh, I got to read about this.
Well, yeah. Too. And if you're curious about the funeral industry, how it exists, you know, today. Like that American Way of Death, that is a great book by Jessica Milford, for sure.
Jessica Milford, you said?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that, like, just, I'm just recapping what we talked about. And the Frances Glessner Lee, that's her name.
And the fact that there's so much information to read about means that people want to talk about it. So it's okay to talk about this.
Right.
It's like anything else. It's like talking about, you know, early sexual experiences and, you know, when we're going through puberty or like those developmental milestones. Mm-hmm. This is just another one of those uncomfortable conversations that is on the timeline that is our life. it's getting kind of late for me.
Yeah. Not really. Well, I have to get up at 4, so.
So, yeah, but, you know, we've covered a lot. We've covered a lot.
We have.
Also encourage people that, you know, if they want to hear more about this or if they want to ask questions, like, I'm sure we'll talk again sometime soon. So if people want to email at nursinguncensoredpodcast@gmail.com or, you know, go to nursinguncensored.com, you can send an email that way. Comments on social media, you got a million choices, but right. If people want to talk about this more, I know you'd be down to talk about
absolutely, like, yeah, like ask me anything.
And I also know that you are a lover of horror movies as well, so yes. I want to wish you a happy Halloween and happy movie watching.
Well, thank you. Happy Halloween to you too.
Thank you. I have to ease my way in, so it's, you know, I don't know when this will be released. It'll be released in the next few weeks, but it's now like the end of September. And so I'm like dipping my toes in with some of the more like kitschy Halloween movies, like you know, the Beetlejuice and the Hocus Pocus and, you know, those like kind of fun ones to get started. Like I think I'm doing a Harry Potter-ish style costume, but I'm not going to do a main character. Like I want to do something that's like kind of unexpected, and I can't say too much because I don't want to give it away.
Yeah, I haven't decided what I'm going to be yet, but one of the things I always wanted to be was the Frances McDormand character from Fargo, Marge Gunderson.
God, yes.
Because I can talk just like her. I can't do it now on command.
That's okay. That's okay. That would be awesome. I believe. I can hear you doing this.
And I love that movie so much. And so one of these years I'm going to do it. I don't know if it'll be this year, but
yeah, you know, there are costumes that I have been kind of sitting on in the idea bank until the moment, like there needs to be. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, but the Halloween decorating is about to begin. As soon as we hang up, I'm going to take an exam that I really don't want to take. no, this is good. This is good because now I'm awake. I'm thinking, like,
you're stimulated.
I'm not just like on the couch with a bag of chips. So I'm going to take my podcaster hat off and put my student hat back on and take this exam. But then I have like craft supplies all over my desk because I'm DIYing some Halloween decorations.
So
I'm super excited about that. But I don't know. It's going to be like, my house is going to be decorated by like before October even hits. So,
well, that's awesome. Well, good luck on your test.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, same to you. And to everyone listening, happy nursing.
Bye.
Bye. Here at Nursing Uncensored, we may be, well, uncensored, but we're not unfiltered. Protected health information has been changed and concealed to comply with HIPAA. The things we talk about are from years of experience with thousands of patients, things we've read, stories we've heard. If you think we're talking about you, we're not. Also, we're real nurses here to provide helpful and accurate information. But don't take anything we say as fact without doing your own research. Refer to your state's Board of Nursing, Practice Acts, and your institution's policies and procedures if you have questions about your practice. Lastly, our very strong opinions are ours alone and do not reflect those of our employers, educational, or professional institutions. Thanks for listening, and happy nursing, folks!